As we sail into all of the 2024 elections, those taking place this spring and those taking place a little bit later in the year, it's going to be important not only to focus on the players and the issues, but it is going to be more important than ever before to know who you can trust, to be able to think critically about the information you're being given, who it's coming from, who are the powers behind them, and what, if any, points of view or biases do you have to be concerned with. Another area of concern is that even though this is a really important year, it seems like the number of sources for us to get this really critical information, especially information having to do with our own towns and our own state, it just seems like those sources are disappearing on a daily basis. Longtime local newsman David Lehman and I have talked about this before, and we decided that it was worth a discussion here on the radio to maybe give you a little bit of background of, you know, where this is coming from, where it's been, how it started. David Lehman joins me now. How are you, David?
Hi, Joan. Good to talk to you again. Nice to be back, having been with you just last week, talking about this really, I think, a very, very critical issue. And it comes at a time, as you pointed out, when you really do need to have solid forms of tested communication and fact-checking and so on, which we're drifting farther and farther away from as a result of so many people on the Internet. I mean, the Internet provides us so many access points to information. Unfortunately, a lot of that information is false. I mean, just lies. But they're lies that people pass on because they can. They get a following and all of that. And then when the traditional media calls attention to it and says, you know, that may have been interesting reading, but it's stable. It's absolutely false. And then people say, well, that's just the liberal, you know, mainstream media fighting for their lives. They don't want to have anybody else trying to, you know, horn in on their information gathering and information dissemination. And that's really, you know, that's just part of the problem, but that's also a big part of the problem. In fact, this whole problem of the decline of the news media is really, really huge. And somebody, I've spent three decades, as you know, as a reporter, news anchor in major markets, early on in smaller markets, which was traditionally the way you did it. And I've spent time in corporate communications. You've done that as well, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, I've said this, and I said this quite carefully when I was in the corporate communications business, when I'd be preparing people to talk to the media, I would tell them, I said, you know, unfortunately, or fortunately for you folks in business, there's never been a better time to be able to get out there and spin stuff that just isn't true. Now, I would never promote that, by the way. But, you know, now is the best time if you're a crooked politician. There are very few watchdogs out there. And most of the time, television and newspapers will focus on organizations or government, really, that don't buy advertising. And so we can get into that a little bit as well. But, you know, the decline of local news in the U.S. has really been speeding up. It just keeps getting worse. A couple of statistics that the audience might find interesting. The country has lost one-third of its newspapers since 2005 and two-thirds of its newspaper journalists since 2005. Think about that. Newspapers are dying, and the average of three newspapers closing every week in just the past year. And most publications are just leaving their coverage areas, in many cases, without local news. Now it's really referred to, it's got a name, they're called news deserts. And you know, newspaper towns, they used to have a couple of major newspapers in Chicago, but you know, at one time, you know, then big cities used to have four or five, six major newspapers competing. They're now down to one or two. St. Louis, where I grew up, there was a St. Louis Post-Dispatch and a St. Louis Globe Democrat. The Globe Democrat's been gone for years. It's a one-newspaper town, and yet it's in the top 25 markets. So, you know, it's just, to me as a journalist, it just is just very, very sad. And I think the repercussions on this are absolutely shocking, and the whole idea about the threat to democracy is real. It is. I used to kind of think, that's a little bit of an overstatement. Boy, I'll tell you what, it was actually an understatement.
You know, it's interesting. In this month's Washington Monthly, I interviewed Philip Longman, and his article was How Fighting Monopoly Can Save Journalism. And I have a very cursory following of business news. I have enough to do with politics. But his point was that there's a Department of Justice suit against Google. And his argument is without a lot of attention, basically Google, you know, people are saying, well, you know, this, like the Chicago Tribune, you know, if only they had a better digital site, you know, they could transition to the next generation. And he said, but it's like the deck is stacked against all these people because the way Google structured things, they have basically sucked up the vast majority of any kind of digital ads, even digital ads. He explained it to me. And again, not a businesswoman. But there's Google has put a mechanism in place where even ads that don't run on Google products, they still get a cut of those. And he said it's not that, you know, the local news organizations who tried to develop these digital arms when the print advertising dried up, it's like they didn't have a chance because of this monopoly. And he said that there's a DOJ lawsuit now that is going to address just this issue. And he said, you know, whether it succeeds or not, it might pressure Google into changing their business model and give some of these outlets that are starved for advertising dollars an actual chance to compete. I was completely ignorant of that particular side of this equation, you know, because I would always think in terms of, well, you know, younger people, short attention spans, you know, they don't want to read a newspaper, that maybe it was just an evolution. But it seems to be more than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a confluence of a lot of things happening at one time. And I know I run the risk of sounding like somebody who's older, just looking back and condemning anything.
Well, that's who we are. Let's embrace it.
Well, I mean, you know, and you know, that's also part of the wisdom of being older. I mean, you know, you could be sort of an old codger, quote unquote. I don't consider myself an old codger, but my birth date probably would tell the truth on me. But you know, there are a lot of things that have happened here in a relatively short period of time. I'm talking about the last 40 years. If you think about it, I have two daughters. Both are, one is 27 and one is 28. One is an entrepreneur. She's a jewelry designer, has her own business. You know, it's really kind of new, but she's been doing it for 5 years. My other daughter is in high tech in Amsterdam. These two have no concept of what's going on internationally or nationally. They do see headlines on their phones and on their computers, but there's no depth to it. And when I sit and talk to them, I mean, they all kind of glaze over, even when I'm talking to them about Donald Trump, which actually is kind of a fascinating story or stories, really, of all that he is accused of. And I can tell about 2 minutes into the conversation, they're kind of glazed over and all of that. There isn't that care. And I say that just because I see this in my own personal life with my own daughters.
Oh, no. I mean, the same is true with my kids. And it's not it's not, some people are just politically averse. My kids are not politically averse. I mean, they were, you know, my son at least was a Bernie bro at one point. But the amount of information that they get or that they even care to look for is shockingly little to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that goes back to the next point that I was going to make. Less than a third, and maybe more like 20% of the students graduating from high school and elementary school as well, have had any civics or government training, I say training classes. I grew up where, you know, we had it. I mean, it was part of our curriculum. And while I will tell you, I was bored stiff with most of it. some of that has to do with just, you know, it's that can be kind of heady stuff. I didn't know the difference between a state representative and a U.S. representative. Mm-hmm. And I hate to tell you, I don't know that I really truly understood that even when I graduated from college. And I later went on, having realized that this stuff is really critical and important, I later went back and got my master's degree in political science, something I had avoided in college because I thought they were a bunch of eggheads, you know. but the fact is that we're training and educating our kids about so many other things and not about government, how it works. And that's really important because you're going to, spend a third of the money you earn in the course of your lifetime. You're going to give it to the federal government or your state government. You ought to know something about that because you're an investor. You are really an investor in government, and really you're an investor in politics as well, because politics is what fuels government, because that's how you have government. And so there's a whole lot of importance attached to this. And even if you don't really understand, you know, how many members of Congress there are, or what's the difference between what the Senate does and what the House of Representatives does, and how they're different from the president, if you know some of that, as you get a little bit older and you start to have true buy-in with society, and that means when you have your own house, if you can afford one now, and if you're going into business or whatever, you suddenly need to know some of this. And because you're getting a little bit more mature, you want to learn a little bit more. How did this happen? It's just amazing to me how little people know, but yet they'll tell you, they can name you the top 15 songs that Taylor Swift had gold, turned gold on, you know. So our whole sense of what's important is so skewed. And now, and as you know, when we were growing up in our business, the people who watch television news were typically those 25 and above, and more typically 34 and above, okay? But they were also the spending class. And so that was a good audience to have. If you had to have an audience, that's the one you wanted. All right. And before that, you knew that, 20-year-olds, 12, 15, 20-year-olds, they're not going to be reading newspapers. They didn't do it then. They certainly are not doing it now. But they eventually, as they had families and they had an investment in their neighborhood and their property and their government, they got to be a little bit more aware of what was going on and would pick up a paper or would read things that were of critical importance. They were being socially active and civically active. You don't see that anymore. You know, and nobody goes to town meetings because nobody knows anything about what's going on in their town because their newspaper, if they had one, is gone. Yeah. And quite frankly, and this is kind of a dirty secret, a lot of the reporters, and I've seen this in television, that's really my area of expertise. In television, the institutional voices, the older reporters, the older anchors who knew the community, and even if they didn't know the community from the time they were a kid, that, you know, like people mm-hmm. like me, I moved from town to town, you did it yourself. But I would get into that town, and I would know that town better than most of the senior citizens there after I was there for 6 months or a year. because I cared about it. You look at the reporters today, and there are exceptions to this, by the way, but for the most part, because of the economics of television, it used to be the golden goose. I mean, you know, lots of money. They paid news anchors and news reporters pretty well and so forth. Now, you'll see a lot of the people who are in television now are very young. They're very inexperienced. You look at a major market, and if they're advertising for a reporter, they'll say, well, you need to have at least 2 years' experience in television news. My God, 2 years' experience when I was getting into the business, that would consign you to Quincy, Illinois, and to Joplin, Missouri, or whatever. And now, if you've got 2 years' experience, you are now marginally qualified to work in the top 20 market. And that, and a lot of times I hate to say this, it's a little stereotyping maybe, but a lot of the people who are on television now just, they're on TV just to be on TV, and if they got to do news, they'll kind of fake it. And I know that's a very broad stroke, and I don't mean that for everybody, but I think that's probably truer now than it was before. And so you don't end up getting good. So if you do get people watching TV news or working for a local newspaper, you're not getting the kind of devoted experience. People, I got into the business when I was making no money at all. I got into the business because I loved it. I never expected to make good money. I ended up making really good money because I was in the golden age when people watched
when the
TV
jobs
news.
Actually even during the golden age, the starter jobs still, which were legion, didn't pay all that well. But you had the opportunity to move up, whether it was moving up to a bigger city or moving up to a bigger job at your station. The opportunity for growth was there, and. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. I mean, and now it just amazes me what reporters are expected to do, because it isn't just go out and cover this story and we want, you know, one version put together for the 5 o'clock news and another version put together for the 6 o'clock news. And now it's also, and you've got to write the story for the website, and don't forget to tweet about the story and make sure you link to the story on your personal social media. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure I could even do the job anymore.
I have to agree with you. I thought the same thing. And the other thing, too, this may be a little bit into the weeds for your listeners, but I think it might be helpful for them to know this. When you and I went out on stories wherever you were in your markets, wherever I was, I went out originally in St. Louis. I went out. I was a reporter. I also went out with a cameraman, a sound man, and a light man. And eventually, and they were men, by the way. That's another big change. And then eventually the technology changed, and also stations didn't want to have to send four people out to do a job that maybe two could do.
Right.
Well, now they send one person out, and very often it's a young woman, inexperienced, and they have to, as you point out, do all those other things. Plus, they're carrying their own gear. They're setting up some of them are setting up their own live shots. We used to have a separate crews that would do that. You'd have a satellite truck. But the equipment has gotten a lot easier to do. But again, somebody's got to do it, and it's all falling on the reporter. And they're now expected to do two, maybe three stories a day. A couple of them had to be live shots. And they're far more newscasts now. Gone are the days when you had a noon show, a 6 o'clock and a 10 o'clock. Now, I mean, TV stations, because quite honestly, the TV stations aren't doing this for the most part because they want to be more civically responsible. They're doing it because when Oprah had her show on the air, everybody wanted to have Oprah leading into your early newscast because it delivered a big audience. But Oprah's show cost so much money for a local station in franchise fees that they lost a huge amount of money on that. But they hoped to move that audience into their newscast where they would make, have a higher rating, and they'd get more money for their ads locally. Well, they eventually found that with Jeopardy and some of these other shows, I've got their a larger list of them. Those shows you still have to pay money for. Mm-hmm. And they got them. They said, you know what? We've got 25 people, 35 people, 70 people in the newsroom. You know, we'll just have them do more. So we'll add a newscast. And their idea of adding a newscast was simply adding a newscast and maybe hiring a producer, maybe one additional reporter, which is really squeezing what is already a tight newsroom in trying to, stretch out all of your resources over more newscasts. And so eventually what you end up having is kind of like a daily newspaper now. It's still a daily newspaper, but there ain't nothing in it. And if it is, it's mostly syndicated stuff. Or it's pulled stories from the other area newspapers that same conglomerate newspaper owner also owns. So if you drive 20 minutes to another city, you'll see some of the same news stories there because the economy of all of this. They're sharing it, and so the localism is sort of going out the window because if something's happening 40 or 50 miles away, I may not really care about that because unless it's something really significant, I may not care about that. But that's what's in my newspaper. So then when they raise the rates on the newspaper, the Providence Journal used to be like $150 to $200, a year. It's now $740 a year.
Oh, my God, you're kidding me.
And there's nothing to speak of. I shouldn't say nothing, but, it isn't
compared to what you remember, yeah.
Yeah, well, not what I remember, but what was. What was. So you end up having people who, here's where it comes down to the civic, getting out of the media industry for a minute. The effect of all this is you have people who know less about what's going on. And so those who do know what's going on, whether they're the business owners or the union people or whatever, they can get away with a lot of stuff that they might not have gotten away with before. And so society is diminished as a result of that. And you end up, you end up having a Matt Gaetz, getting elected, or what's his name, Sandoz, who just got kicked out. You have to ask, I don't know whether you thought about this, what was the local media doing that George Santos got elected? Nobody knew anything about this guy. Yeah. He was a complete fraud.
There was a local Long Island newsletter slash, I don't know if they rise to the level where we can call them a newspaper. They did a story. They were the only outlet. And, in the past, big organizations paid attention to what, little organizations, national networks looked at what states and local reporters, especially at O&O's, properties that were owned by the big networks were doing. And they would build on that. They would continue on with that reporting. The person who was in charge of this Long Island newsletter said that it dumbfounded them at the time. But nobody, there was no newspaper, there was no digital site, nobody called them to follow up on their reporting. And they reported, hey, this guy's got a lot of holes in his background. Not everything he says seems to be true. And then the rest of us discovered that, like, oh, my God, how did this happen? And this little Long Island publication was like, we knew, but nobody paid any attention to us.
Right. So, a segment of New York had this guy representing them. I mean, this was their guy.
Yeah.
And, it was a lack of due diligence on the part of the newspapers. It was a lack of due diligence on the part of the party. The party should have known something about this guy before they got behind him. And again, some people listening to this conversation might say, well, that's just one. That's like a one off. You can't blame, our current crisis, just because you got one guy who slipped through. There are a lot of people who have slipped through. And one of the good things about television And quite honestly, it's one of the good things about CNN and MSNBC is that there is so much videotape. Everybody's got a phone. They record these people saying one thing on Saturday, and on Monday they say something else. And now they can show it back to back that the individual was lying. In all fairness, when I got into the business back in the late 60s, early 70s, it wasn't that easy to prove that somebody was not telling the truth in order to have the evidence. I mean, you knew the guy was not telling the truth because you heard one thing and said another, but it may not have been on camera. So now it's your word, either as a political opponent or as even as a reporter. Well, he said this. Oh, I never said that. You're making that up. You've got something against me. So there's some good in all this as well. But the fact of the matter is you really need to have truth tellers. And we don't have a lot of truth tellers. And I don't know how the people on Fox News get up in the morning. They must not have mirrors. I figured this out. They're probably unique because none of their people have mirrors. Because if you had a mirror, you'd have to look at yourself in that mirror every day and say, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah. You know, is the money, this stuff, do I love the fame and the money enough to just completely lie to the audience and myself every day? Yeah. David, we need to take a break. Dave Layman and I are going to be right back with this discussion in a minute. I am joined by longtime local newsman Dave Layman. We have been talking about the evolution of the current situation with how you get your information, or maybe how you don't get your information. You know, like you, David, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I want to run something by you that has occurred to me. News, when it was first on, and I don't know, was that back in the 50s, maybe just shortly after the onset of television? It was considered a public service. It was something that people had to do to justify their license with the government. Oh, yes, we care about people. Look, we're doing 15 minutes of news because the original news programs weren't even half an hour. And so it was considered, it wasn't considered a profit center. So it was just something that was done for the public good. And the wonderful thing about that is that there was no pressure to take a certain point of view. There was no pressure whether or not somebody was taken to task. It was just the facts, ma'am. It was like, this happened today. This bill was passed. You know, this person, the president said this. And because of that evolution, the earliest people who really were in our homes all the time, I'm thinking about people like Walter Cronkite. We, as a society, we learned to really trust them. And because there wasn't a huge corporate organization behind them saying, oh, don't do that story, that'll lose us a sponsor or this or that. And I think that especially our generation, people our age and older, we developed that habit of trust. And that's what I think Fox News has used to fashion this sort of different version of reality, mostly in an older population. A couple years ago, I read it was like they did a demographic look at all the major cable organizations, and they all skewed old, but nobody skewed older than Fox. Their average viewer was like 70. Not that 70 is old anymore. I just want to be clear about that. But
be careful.
But we're the generation that grew up with, they sort of like they said it on TV, so it must be true. And I think that there's for all of their rejection of the sources of information that we came to rely on, I think they have, to some degree, a more cynical, maybe a more realistic view of information that comes their way. They don't automatically believe it. I mean, I'm sure you do, too. I know certain relatives who watch nothing but Fox, and, you know, you sit with them at the dinner table, and, you know, you realize that their conversation is a regurgitation of Fox talking points. And you know, sadly, with us, you know, we usually avoid the conflict and just like change the subject or dismiss a subject very quickly. But I think that that's where that's where Fox has had so much influence with a generation that learned that if it was, they couldn't say it on TV if it wasn't true. Right, David? They couldn't say it if it wasn't true.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Well, let me take issue with you on maybe one or two points. The 1960s was not the golden age of television news. I have to tell you, very much of the way television news and you know, even the newspapers to some extent are mirroring what it was like back in the 1960s. I got into the business of news in the late 60s, and I can tell you it really wasn't a lot of very good journalism. I mean, it was like the baby steps to get into the 60s or into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, which were really the golden years. You had consumer reporters on every station. You had investigative reporters separately from the consumer reporters. They were doing hard-hitting stories. The leading complaints by most surveys, by the Better Business Bureau, I think, and others, were the consumer complaints, the highest number were on about cable TV when it came into being, and car dealerships. And you would be hard-pressed today to see any TV station or any newspaper do any kind of investigative reporting on the local automobile dealers or on cable.
Hmm.
And there's a reason for that. Now, you know, life has changed in other ways that you know, would nibble away a little bit about what I'm saying. But, you know, car dealerships, I work for a station. I'm not going to identify the station, but I raised an issue about favorable coverage to local auto dealers and the fact that we didn't cover consumer complaints about these. And the president of the company, he and I had a very serious conversation after I had been on board for about a year. And I felt I really needed to feed back to him before I became part of the wallpaper there. I still had fresh eyes. And I said to him, and we had a huge argument about this. I said, you know, there's a sense in the newsroom, we can't do a story without somebody else's approval up here in the general offices on a car dealership. And he said, absolutely untrue, absolutely untrue. That's not true. We argued and argued about this because I was telling him what the perception was. And eventually, he got so tired of the conversation with me, he said, well, let me tell you something, Dave. Your pay is funded 44% by our car dealer ads. Now, if you go out and find 44% somewhere else, I'm all ears. So he basically caved in to my argument. And, of course, my response to him was, you didn't hire me to become a salesperson for the sales department. You hired me to be sure that we're putting on the best newscast that we can do. And so I said, what you need to do is you need to go out and get salespeople who can get other people other than car dealers to come in here so they're not so dominant, and you're having to yield to them. And he was kind of taken aback by that, I guess either because he'd run out of arguments or he thought, God, you know, the guy's making some sense here. But think about this. If almost half the station's profits, and it may not be that high in a lot of areas, but let's say 25% of the profits, car dealerships, if you look at local news, you'll see a car dealership, in the same commercial break, you'll see a Ford commercial, a Chevy truck commercial backed by one other thing. You know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it was a policy that you couldn't run a commercial of an opponent business in the same commercial pot. It had to be spread out into the next one. So if I was a Ford dealership, if I had an ad, they ran at 6:15 right after weather, another car dealership couldn't be in that same commercial pod, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they run them back-to-back with impunity, and there's nothing wrong with that, except it goes to show you how it is. And another point I would make is, I remember the salespeople at the stations that I worked for, and I worked for some really, really good, high-end, honorable stations. I was very fortunate about that. I remember they hated election years, because under federal law, you had to give a candidate for office, you had to give him the lowest possible rate for his commercial because, you know, they're doing something that's civic. Well, now there is so little money around for advertising that the TV stations look forward to every 4 years or mm-hmm. every 2 years because it brings in all this money. And I don't know what the rules are now, but what they, I don't know whether they have to pay a going rate or whether it's still they have to give them the lowest rate for that time slot. But it goes to show you, I mean, it's mind-boggling that they hated you know, political commercials because they were cheap. They couldn't charge much. And now they love them because it helps keep them afloat mm-hmm. for another year or two. So
yep.
there have been a lot of big changes. And I'll make one other point here. And I wrote you a note last week going back. This is a little bit of a throwback. It's not Throwback Thursday yet, but a lot of your older viewers will remember the years of Walter Cronkite, Huntley Brinkley, and whoever was doing ABC at the time. Walter Cronkite at one time had 30 million viewers a night watching the CBS Evening News. Today, the CBS Evening News draws 5 million people, sometimes a little less. ABC, which is the leader, has a 9 million audience, 9 million people watching. NBC has about 7 million. If you add all of those together, they don't equal what Walter Cronkite had back in the late 70s. It goes to show you the diminishing element of this with the audience for network news. Now, a lot has changed here. There's much more news available, and I get it. But it's just an interesting throwback mm-hmm. to think about that, that Walter Cronkite, 30 million, that's almost in the range of Super Bowl numbers.
Yeah,
you know, almost touching Super Bowl. But that was when they had appointment television. If you missed the news, you missed it. There was no cable to go to.
There were no VCRs or DVRs or TiVos or on-demand.
Right. Yeah. But that's an interesting, just to give you a sense of how the audience has diminished. Now, local television news, I should point out, in spite of what we've said, local television news, while it has diminished a good deal in terms of its overall numbers, it's one of the few spots that has kind of settled into a regular audience. It's a much reduced audience. But the loss of viewership for local television news has kind of stemmed a bit. But it stemmed at a much lower rate than what it used to be. I remember the station I worked with in Columbus, WBMS, where you were. I remember we had the highest rated CBS 11 o'clock news in the country, or 10 o'clock news in the country. And that was a powerhouse. I mean, you know, the salespeople who worked at the TV station, these people were order takers. They didn't have to go out and convince anybody. It used to be if you wanted to sell your product, you had to be on television. Or the newspapers, but more so television. But again, think about all those advertising dollars that used to go to CBS, ABC, and NBC. They are now spread out over, 500 channels, not counting digital and all of that. So that's where all that has gone. And newspapers used to make all kinds of money as well. I remember just one other point. The station I worked at in Dallas, the word was that station, every dollar they took in, 50 cents of that was profit.
Oh.
Think about that.
Oh, my God.
A normal company, a prosperous company today, hopes to make about 8 to 10% profit. They were doing well over 50% profit. but they were also a cheap TV station by most standards. But it was so profitable. Now, I don't know what the television station's profit lines are. There are probably some that are still, 15% profit, which is still terrific. Grocery stores only make a 1.5 to 2.5% profit, just to give you a sense of what an accordion we had here. Good. With TV stations that we used to refer to it. You've heard this many a time. The TV stations were a license to print money. They were just so profitable.
Yeah. Hey, David, hang on a second. We've had a caller who's been waiting to join our conversation. Steve is calling in. Hey, Steve, you're on with me and Dave Lehman. Go ahead.
Yes, I think it's an immensely interesting conversation. And to put it in context with regard to Cronkite, I mean, keep in mind that you were talking about in 1970 a population of a little over 200 million in this country versus 335 million today. So, imagine, right. Think about how the distinction. And beyond that, I absolutely agree with you. And there's an additional problem that, extends beyond people not tuning into something that has credibility, that today you can tune into whatever suits your ideological bent. So, in other words, people had no idea what Cronkite thought until years after he retired, whether he was a Democrat or Republican, conservative or liberal. And people liked that. And Johnson famously said, once Cronkite had mentioned with regard to his views on the Vietnam War, once I lost Cronkite, I've lost the American people. And yep. And exactly. That's the kind of power that they had. Mm-hmm. But, unfortunately today, young people do not understand the distinction between these various outlets. I had a student during COVID, I got roped into teaching a political science class. And I had a student email me a while ago and ask me what I thought about this analysis. And it was from a YouTube channel. And it's a guy playing video games talking about public policy. And I'm like, what in God's name are you sending me? And how is this your idea of a credible resource in terms of analysis of what's going on in your society? But this is the thing. Young people think that a guy with a YouTube page and 800,000 followers is an alternative to something that's on C-SPAN. And it's not.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That just sounds like so very today. Well, he may have been a gamer, Steve, but he was talking about policy.
Yeah.
Well, and I could start a channel and talk about medicine. Forget the fact that I've never been to medical school. I mean, what does that matter,
Yeah. Everybody's an expert now, and especially the people who have big followings. Somehow that lends the kind of credibility to somebody that they actually used to have to earn.
the American people are finally starting to grasp the idea, this concept called epistemic responsibility. It used to be something that you heard in graduate schools and philosophy classes and journalism classes, a few other places. Now people are starting to understand what that means, that you have a responsibility when you have an audience to actually have some basis for what you're saying, some educational background, some qualifications, experience.
Yeah.
Steve, to your point about a student, I taught a number of semesters in college, broadcast news, writing, and journalism, and it was eye-opening to me, being a news anchor and reporter all those years, and also doing this more as a community service than anything else, teaching college. And I had assigned a reading from the book of Robert Kennedy, The Life and Times of Robert Kennedy, I think it was. And I assigned a chapter in there, and one of the students in my class raised her hand, and she said, Mr. Lehman, now this Robert Kennedy book that you want us to read an excerpt from, now is he related at all to the Kennedys of Massachusetts?
Holy crap. Oh my God.
And this is in Rhode Island.
Oh my God.
Next door to Massachusetts, where the Kennedys were clearly the legacy family of all generations.
But unbelievable.
When I heard that, oh my God, I thought, have we lost a generation? And that was
really
back in the late 80s.
I will tell you, though, one thing that gives me hope, and it isn't, it's not across the board, but a lot of communities, I'm sure you're seeing it too, are creating these hyper-local news organizations. Like, the There used to be something called DNA Info, but it went out of business. And here in Chicago, a group of those reporters got together and they started something called Block Club Chicago. And I've heard of these kinds of things, like the Courier newsrooms are trying to do these hyper local, largely digital kinds of websites, some for political news, some just for neighborhood news. What do you think of that trend, David?
Well, ironically, I proposed that quite a number of years ago. I built out a whole proposal for local television stations to have a hyper-local newscast as part of their newscast lineup, and having a reporter assigned to each section of the state. Again, this is Rhode Island, so it's you're talking about the equivalent of a big city, where you would get to the stories before even maybe the Providence Journal might get to it or the Boston Globe. And but I couldn't get any takers on it because, you know, even then they were still trying to figure out how they were going to, you know, manage what they already had. And so it really went nowhere. And I actually called it the hyperlocal newscast. But I think it's still a model that with some modification could work today. Because what you're doing is, I did something, you might find this interesting, Joan. I hired a person who I didn't want to have any aspirations to be on the air. And I didn't want her to be assigned to the assignment desk at all. Her job was to reach out to each and every city and town in Rhode Island and to find the local renegade, if you will, or the local person who went to the town meetings, you know, it's something they just believed in. They really were kind of like the squeaky wheel in the town, because they almost always knew the stories that newspapers would die to get, the local newspapers would die mm-hmm. to get. And her job was to contact them twice a week, at least once a week and twice a week. And we developed more stories out of that because it showed that, we cared, that there's a little bit of a hyper-local aspect to that as well. And we broke more stories. We got people out of office. We did all sorts of things. But, you know, another news director came in after I stepped down, and he thought, well, I could use that as another reporter. And, you know, so that got swallowed up into the news machine, as opposed to being this independent person who reported directly to me so that I could be sure that she was doing what I wanted her to do, and she had no aspirations of being on the air. So she got a big kick out of being able to break a story because she wouldn't do the story. She would get the information, turn it over to a reporter, and he would go out and do it. So this was a very efficient way of finding news stories, because if you've got a reporter doing all that, they're not mm-hmm. out in the street doing a story for that newscast that night. So anyway,
that was a model that should have been in place in a lot of different newsrooms. And that's absolutely brilliant. And that's kind of here in town, Block Club Chicago. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. They have reporters that basically live in the neighborhoods, and they're assigned like four different neighborhoods. And, you know, mm-hmm. they talk to the shop owners and they go to the coffee shops and listen to the conversations, and they figure out what's happening there. And it's always a really fascinating read. And Courier Newsroom is kind of, as best I understand it, trying to take that model. They do these websites and newsletters, and they'll tell you, like, you know, the best place to get hot cocoa this weekend when it's going to be cold, or the best place to ice skate. But then what they do is they get their local audience, and then they add some political stuff. By the way, there's a school board election coming up, and you should know mm-hmm. that one of the candidates is from Moms for Liberty. And they mm-hmm. feel that this is a really effective way to reach people who don't want to read about politics and government.
Right. Well, I just had a fleeting thought there. Let me see if I can pull it back. On a positive note, since we're coming up towards the end of the hour, on a positive note, even about Trump, who I consider to be the world's most dangerous man, I remember being so aggravated in the 90s. You know, the economy for the most part in the 90s was really good. Bill Clinton, who I didn't care for a whole lot, when he left office, we had no national debt. I mean, there's no question about that. Everything was so good, nobody cared about hard news. I mean, this was the rise of some of these celebrity shows you'd see every night. And nobody wanted to talk about anything serious. So it was always about the equivalent of the Kardashians at the time or whatever. And I kept thinking, why? Is everybody dazzled by the fact that the economy is good? You know, everybody was working. The unemployment rate was actually just a little bit higher than what it is now. So it was a full employment economy. And I thought, God, these people need to be focusing on some of the serious issues. We've got an environment to worry about. We've got a crime problem still. And one thing that Trump has done, this is kind of like good coming out of evil, is people are very, very much attuned now to a lot of policy things. You know, they may not be very well informed about them, but at least the public discussion is about some items of substance, whether it's health care, you know, Social Security, Medicare, the border, and so on. And unfortunately, not a whole lot is getting done about some of that, but at least it's part of the conversation. It wasn't the conversation in the 1990s, no matter how we viewed them as halcyon days for the news business. It was celebrity time because nobody was worried about anything to speak of except for, you know, AIDS and things like that. You know, you never escape that, or you never escape serious issues like that. But there was no public dialogue to speak of the way it was in the 70s with the Vietnam War, with the, you know, feminism, you know, civil rights and all of that. And I just thought that was a decade of everybody was just out, you know, on cocaine or something. Nobody paid any attention. Now, one of the benefits of having this awful guy as our former president, and who I still say is going to end up in jail, is the fact that people are talking about serious things, and it's now so serious though, that I think we're inundated by it, and it affects the overall mood of the country, which is not good.
David, we got to wrap this up. An hour has flown by. Thank you so much for sharing this hour with me. I think this is an important discussion, and I think it's good background for folks going into an election year. Appreciate it, my friend. And by the way,
all
that
right,
picture, you look just as handsome as always, even if the hairline is a little tiny bit further back.
I'm still searching for it.
We're going to take a break for news, and we'll be back with more after this.